This is the 24th of April, 1994, and my name is Dennis Stevens, and I'm cutting this tape for Anthony Phillips, and the subject matter of the tape, as requested by Anthony, is L. Ron Hubbard, the man that I knew. My personal contact with Ron Hubbard stretched from a period from September 1952 through to 1955, late 1955, early 1956 actually. Then there was a break when we went to Australia, and there was no personal contact then from a period until 1962, when I did the St. Hill briefing course. And again, there was a personal contact with Ron Hubbard while I was on the St. Hill briefing course during the year 1962. There was, of course, a comm line to Ron that continued on and off over the years. Even when I was in Sydney, I had a comm line working with the org, working in the field. I always did have a comm line to Ron. I could always write to him and get a reply from him, a personal reply from him at any time. And of course, while I was in the org, I had a direct comm line to the old man as well. I will refer to him as the old man because I always knew him as the old man. It's only in later years that I've stopped calling him the old man and started to call him Ron Hubbard, but affectionately, like many staff members, ex-staff members, I know Ron as the old man. There was no personal or written comm with Ron after 1965. So that gives you some idea of the period involved. The most intimate contact with Ron Hubbard was in the period from 1952 to late 1955, and that is the period that Anthony has asked me to concentrate on, because evidently there is some scarcity of people around who have commented on their personal contact with Ron during this period. Apparently all the articles and so forth that have appeared on contact with Ron have been later than 1955. Well, I hope to be able to remedy that scarcity. It's necessary for me to give a brief resume of my Scientology history to understand how I did actually get into contact with him. My first contact with Dianetics was through the Astounding Science Fiction magazine article. I had a subscription to the Astounding Science Fiction magazine in 1950. And as soon as that article appeared in the magazine in May 1950, I wrote off for the book Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. And it was air freighted over, and I started using it, started co-auditing in September 1950, and subsequently found out that my co-auditor and I were we were the second co-auditing team to start up in Britain. So I go a long way back in England, Dianetics and Scientology in England. I subsequently joined the Wishlow Northwest London Dianetic Group, run by George Wishlow, and I became the group secretary, and continued on as a group auditor and group secretary through 1950, late 1950, and all through 1951, and all the way through 1952. Until the first contact with Ron Hubbard appears in September 1952. And just to come up to that, give you the reality of what was occurring at that time, the news came through that Ron Hubbard would be coming to London in September 1952. And George Wishlow, the head of the group, he got that word over from America. And prior to that, the only Dianeticist or Scientologist we'd seen from America was Jack Horner. He was the only other one, the only trained one. We'd had a few that had come over and spoken, but they had no, they didn't, you know, they'd only, they were no more than, their use of the subject was no more than ours. They were book auditors and so on. And so the only other one we'd ever spoken to who'd been trained and done an HDA course and a Bachelor of Scientology course was Jack Horner. He arrived in England in 1950, first arrived in England in 1951 and gave a congress, which I attended. And but anyway, the big news, that was the big news, August 1952. I'd been getting very excellent results as a pre-clear from Dianetics, and I was mightily impressed with the subject, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was a very easy running pre-clear. Any auditor would have given his back teeth to have a pre-clear like me. I always was an easy running pre-clear. I didn't know it, of course, but it was only after many years of auditing tough cases that I realised that the vast majority of humanity are much more difficult to audit than I am. Anyway, move now into September 1950, late August 1952 is when he actually appeared. Late August, early September. It might have been late August or early September when he actually appeared at the Wishlow Dianetic Group. This material, by the way, of this period is also mentioned in the memoirs of Dennis Nan Stevens, which is a series of 4.5 hours of the Scientology memoirs of Dennis Nan Stevens, which is in the possession of Greg Pickering. He has the copies and tapes of that. So I'm duplicating here, and I won't duplicate any more than I have to, I can assure you. But my first contact with Ron Hubbard was when he strolled into, there was a knock at the door. Everyone was there. We normally at our group meetings, we had about 15 members, 15 people would turn up, that regulars and visitors, 15 or 20. Well, that night we must have had about 60 people there in that big room of George Wishlow's. And they were almost literally hanging from the chandeliers. The word that he was in London, and his first port of call on that Sunday evening, he was going to devote the whole evening to being with us at the Wishlow Dianetic Group. Was enough to, George had been burning the telephone, and he got all and sundry there. Everyone who could conceivably get there was there that Sunday evening. There's a lot of people from the group, other London groups, who couldn't get there because they too were holding their group meetings on that Sunday. So they couldn't be there, they had to be at their own groups. But other than that, we had about 60 people there, and the meeting progressed. And suddenly there was a knock at the door, and George dashed out and opened the front door, and in strode this. He seemed an enormous, my first impression of Ron, although I'd seen photographs of him, my first impression was his physical size. He seemed a very, very large person. It was only that when I got to know him better and realised that this was a part of the mock-up that he put over of his size, that he wasn't actually anywhere near as big physically as you thought he was. He was near 6 foot, just maybe a shade under 6 foot in height, and probably weighed about, 180 pounds, something like that. And he got a lot heavier than that in the later years, but at that time, he wasn't all that heavy at that time, but he seemed enormously large. And he walked in the room and filled the room immediately. That was impression, was his presence. And he walked into the room, everything stopped, and he was immediately the centre of attention. And so that was my first impression of the man, was his presence, was his physical presence, his startling physical presence, the size of him physically, and his startling psychological presence, the size of him psychologically. One definitely knew that there was somebody there. He was the sort of person that, if he was in the room behind you, you'd know he was behind you, and you would turn round and not be surprised to find the one standing there. That happened to me on many occasions with Ron Hubbard in those early days in the 50s, that Ron would, in the org and so forth, when he was around in the org, I'd be talking to someone in the room and the door would be open, and suddenly I'd be aware that Ron was in the room. I'd know he was there, and I turned around and there he'd walked in and was standing waiting. He wanted to speak to me about something, and he was standing patiently waiting for me to finish a conversation, but I knew he was behind me. I could sense his presence. He was that sort of person. He had an enormous psychological presence, Ron Hubbard did. Anyway, that particular group meeting was a milestone in my life, because as it turned out, my life was never the same again after that group meeting. Ron spoke about Scientology, gave us a talk, and he talked, I suppose, for about three quarters of an hour about Scientology, then answered some questions, and then said he's going to give a demonstration, and he wanted a volunteer to come up. And strangely, there was no, I was mad to get my hand up, but I thought, well, as I was the group's guinea pig, if anyone was going to give a demonstration session, anyone wanted to demonstrate an auditing technique, well, I was always the guinea pig, because I had a virtually indestructible case. I was the easiest running pre-clear, and everyone in the group knew it. That they couldn't, some of the group members could be damaged psychologically by group demonstrations, but they knew that I was indestructible, that they could leave me in an engram and I'd find my way out of it, and no harm would come out of it. I didn't understand it at the time, but it was just a state that I'm a very easy running, I've always been an easy running pre-clear. It was almost impossible to harm me psychologically with the techniques. So I thought, well, I won't put my hand up, because I'll give some of the other members here might like a go at the demonstration. But I looked round, there was no hands going up. Ron was he'd announced that he wanted to give an auditing demonstration of exteriorisation. And maybe that put everyone off, they were a bit scared of it. Not even George Wishlow got his hand up. And George was no person to not come forward when he was interested in something. But in that instant, I thought, oh, well, if nobody else wants the opportunity, it might never happen again. So my hand shot up, and he ran up and smiled at me and called me over to the stand, and my life changed. He did a technique of giving commands to my foot and receiving commands back and turning a few energy masses white and so on. And the next thing, I told him that I was exteriorized, and he said, very good. And he moved me around the room, and the tremendous perception there I was struck with there. It was the weird sensation of sitting there above 60 people, and I could see them all clearly below me. I was up near the ceiling where Ron had moved me, and there was Ron addressing my body, and I could see my body there, I could see Ron there. I could see the whole thing much, much clearer than I could through my eyes. And there it was all happening, and everyone was watching the demonstration, and I was up on the ceiling. And it was an incredible experience. And he moved me around and moved me out into the road, and I found I could move through the wall, and I could see through the wall, all sorts of things I could do. Then he moved me around and got me comfortable and said, do you want to come back into your body or stay outside? I said, no, thank you very much, I'm quite happy out here. So he said, right, well, he got me to open my eyes again, and ended the demonstration. And by that time, it was getting up to 10 o'clock, and people had buses and trains to catch. It being a Sunday, the transport didn't run very late in London at that time. And very quickly, the group meeting broke up, and I had to dash off and get a last bus. And getting off the bus and walking the mile and a half, I'd missed the last bus to connected up to my home. I had to walk a mile and a half along a deserted road to get to my house. And the incredible feeling of walking along there and being exterior from my body, and my body was in front of me. And this weird sensation of walking along and the body in front of me shadowing the streetlights. In other words, as I walked along, suddenly there'd be a street light would appear in my visual field on the right-hand side, as it appeared around the side of my head, where it had been in shadow by my head. It startled me for a moment, like I realised what was going on. I moved further back behind my body, and the exteriorisation was almost complete. It was an almost the type of exteriorisation you would get between lives, as I later discovered. The exteriorisation was incredibly complete. And I just walked for a whole mile and a half down that road, sitting about full 10, 15 foot behind my body, and just moving down the road with my body there, and looking at the houses as I was walking along, and my body was sort of just walking along the road there. It was the most incredible experience. And then I moved, got into my house and went to bed, and again went up into the loft, nosed around on the roof, and ended up sitting out at about midnight, sitting out on the lamppost in the road, watching the moths fly around the lamppost. And there I went to sleep. And when I woke up in the morning, I'd moved back into my body again. But it changed my life. I then knew that Scientology was absolutely right. And I knew that when Ron spoke of exteriorization, talked about a thetan, that he was right. I had so much tremendous personal certainty on it. There was not a shred of doubt in my mind. And when he said then that he said at the group meeting that he was going to run a professional course, well, that was where I wanted to be. That I knew that what he was talking about was the goods. And the one thing I wanted to be was a professional Scientologist, because this was the future. This was the way it was. This enormous exteriorization ability, I was what they used to call at the time a theta clear, stayed with me. It lessened slowly, but it stayed with me for months. It had an interesting validation. I was already courting my future wife at the time, and yes, we were. I knew my future wife. And later on, I'm just kidding, unsnarling the time track. Yes, I was courting her at the time. And we used to, at one point I was in London there. I had a flat in London, and she was down in Battersea. And we couldn't be together that evening. We were very much in love. And I used to go and visit her as a thetan late at night. And she always knew I was there. I could come in, look around the room, and there she would be laying on the bed reading. And I'd go over and touch her forehead, and she'd look up. I could see her look up, and she would look up. And she knew I was there. The following day, I'd phone her or see her. And she'd say, "You were over last night." I'd say, "Yes. Come over and visit you." And she couldn't do it, of course. She hadn't got the ability, but she always knew when I was there. She could sense my presence very, very strongly. So it wasn't all in my mind. There was a present time. There was another person who could validate the exteriorization ability that I had, and the ability to actually be felt, that my presence could actually be felt by another person in the universe, in the present time universe. So it wasn't all imagination. It had validation there. I have been audited by Ron Hubbard more than once, always in demonstration sessions, but I can say without a shadow of a doubt that he was the best auditor that ever audited me. I was never audited by a better auditor than Ron. Ron was the smoothest, and he was the greatest. And I've been audited by some very fine auditors, including Jack Horner, who I rate only just slightly below Ron Hubbard as an auditor. Unfortunately, they're both dead now. But Ron was the greatest as an auditor. He was the greatest auditor. He was the only auditor I ever met, I ever knew, who never really needed an e-meter. Ron could... when you were in session with Ron as a pre-clear, something would happen in session, some mental scene would occur, and Ron would come in and say, what's happening? He knew it. He'd spot it straight away. He didn't need it. He used to use a meter, but he didn't really need one. He knew the slightest change in the session he was onto. That is the mark of the truly great auditor. And Ron had that ability. He was the only auditor I ever knew who had that ability. He could determine the slightest of changes in the pre-clear by direct perception. And he could do it time and time again. And it gave you an enormous feeling of confidence when you were being audited by Ron Hubbard. You felt that he was right there with you, as indeed he was. He was right there with you, holding your hand as the pre-clear in the session. You felt that there was somebody else there holding your hand. And I got that feeling, always got that feeling, whenever Ron audited me. And I never got it with any other auditor. Slightly with Jack Horner, but it was only very, very faint. With Ron, it was strong. And with other auditors, never. I've never experienced it with other auditors at all. So he stood head and shoulders, Ron did, as an auditor. He was head and shoulders above any other auditor I'd ever met. Well, almost needless to say, when you experience something like that from a man, when he audits you, he invented the subject, he discovered the subject, he formulated the subject, and he tries it on you, and it works exactly as he said, and you get validation that it's not all imagination, that it's actually real, and it's working exactly the way he said it, you're inclined to grant this man certain godlike qualities. And when you realise his personality, he had this enormous presence that I've already mentioned, that when he walked into a room, he was there. There was a person there. So he had a physical presence and a psychological presence. And on easy running pre-clears, Ron could make his subject, and I wasn't easy running pre-clear, Ron could make his subject work exactly the way he said it worked. He might not be able to do it on difficult running pre-clears, but he could sure as hell make it work on easy running pre-clears. And the effect on the subject, the effect on me, was to grant him enormous beingness as a person, to grant him almost godlike qualities. And it was inevitable that it would happen, and it did happen. And I was awestruck by the old man. I wonder what sort of a person he was, whether he was a god, a demigod, or what. That was in September 1950. Towards the end, middle of September 1950, I started the HPA course in London. That course was personally taught by Ron Hubbard, and there was about 15 of us on the course. And there was two or three auditing demonstrations. He used to give regular auditing demonstrations, and I think about two or three times I was the subject on the course. He quickly realised, Ron did, that I was a very easy running PC, and when he quickly wanted to demonstrate something, he just lift up and say, Dennis, can I just go over, and he'd run it on me and demonstrate the point he wanted to make. He too, like the group members found, he too was using the advantages of a very, very easy running pre-clear. And a person who, because of the state of case, could be got to do things rather easily, and there will be no ill effects and so forth. So I had two or three auditing demonstrations from Ron during the HPA course. And each one of them, there was that same presence, that same feeling of the master auditor there, when he was auditing me. It's interestingly enough that I spoke to many other people about Ron as an auditor, and many people have been audited by Ron in demonstrations, but not everyone. Many of them did agree that he was a tremendous auditor, but others, I did hear people say that they didn't think much of, they didn't feel that he'd done anything for them at all. They didn't care for his style of auditing, which I thought was most peculiar. But each and every one of these was a tough case. Quite interesting, isn't it? It was a subjective. He obviously, the person was a tough case. The auditing demonstration had not produced any positive result, and the person wasn't particularly impressed. And so it reflected on the pre-clear's feelings about the auditor. I did actually meet more than one person in London at that time who'd been audited by Ron in auditing demonstrations who didn't think he was a particularly good auditor. After the training course, after the course was finished, it goes through, it was an 8-week course, full-time course, we got through to November 1952, and by that time Ron had got the HASI organised in London, and I went on staff immediately. I was the first director of processing on staff. He wanted me on post right away. I completed all my course requirements, sent in my case histories, got my HPA and my HGA certificate. I graduated as close to his honours as it was possible to get, and Ron wanted me. He came straight after me and wanted me as a DOP in HASI London. So I was London's first director of processing, and by that time Anne and I were together. She was my future wife, Anne Walker. And she was the first Association Secretary of London, Anne was. And from that point onwards, once Mary Sue was pregnant at the time with their first child, and once she got over the pregnancy, given birth, and Mary Sue was now around and available again, and started to get back into social life again, quite often, Ron and Mary Sue would invite Anne and I out to dinner in the evening and socially. And we used to get on quite well socially there, but I always got along better with Ron than I did with Mary Sue, and so did Anne. Mary Sue wasn't the easiest of person, the easiest of people to get along with, at least not to a person like me, she wasn't, but I found Ron a very easy person to socially to get along with. As I got to know Ron better, and that's only because we were meeting socially, and in restaurants and so forth, and nightclubs, as I got to know him better, I realised things about him which I hadn't noticed at the beginning, and there's things about Ron, this was the way he would treat everyone. I don't know whether other people noticed this, because I don't think I ever mentioned it to anyone, except for Anne, and she agreed with me, was that Ron didn't experience people. When somebody was talking to Ron, he didn't experience them, he confronted them. Now, there is a difference. If somebody's talking to me, I experience them. I don't confront them. Now, I better possibly explain that. It's a technical thing. To confront means to front with. Now, Ron, in all his life, only fronted with things. He confronted. In fact, he developed a training drill called confronting. He called it confronting. And I think Ron only ever knew how to confront people. He always fronted them with something. He never experienced them. I can confront people. I can put things, I can front with things, and I can experience. When you're experiencing, you're not fronting with anything. You're knowing them. You're experiencing them, and it's quite different from confronting. But Ron evidently didn't use that. Ron, in all his personal dealings with people, he always confronted them. He used to confront them when he was talking to them, and he would confront them when he was listening to them. Whatever was happening, Ron always was confronting, and that was the presence. It was a mock-up, a glowing mock-up, you might say, that he used to put there to confront people with. And that's what you used to sense when he walked into the room. It was to confront. It was the thing he was fronting with. I remember when I first spoke to Anne about this, she almost had a line charge and had a tremendous cognition. She spotted it, but she didn't quite grasp it, didn't quite understand it. She said, yes, it's exactly right, isn't it? That's exactly what he does. He's a confronter. He puts, there's something there, he's putting there for you to look at. And that's what you see. He doesn't experience you. He confronts you. And it's so true about Ron Hubbard. If you knew that about Ron, you know his innermost part of the man's personality that he never experienced. He always confronted. And that maybe it was a weakness in his personality. I don't think Ron ever really experienced anything. He sure as hell confronted. He confronted one hell of a lot. But I don't think he ever really experienced anything. I don't think he was capable of it. But he was one hell of a confronter. Another thing about Ron that I think many people realise this who'd spoken to him, been with him socially, was that he was a conversation hogger. He was if you were at a dinner party, sitting around a table, then the whole evening revolved around you, everyone sitting listening to Ron. It's not that he actually stopped other people from talking, but anything other people said was just ammunition for Ron to come up with something which was usually very, very interesting and very, very worth hearing. In other words, he was a tremendous conversationist, a first-class raconteur. And whatever you had to say pulled into insignificance compared to what he had to say. So everyone would sit with rapt attention and listen to Ron and think that was quite the most natural thing in the world, to listen to Ron talking. I didn't know at the time we used to talk there socially, and he used to talk about his early auditing experiences in the USA with his various auditors. He never had much success with auditors auditing him. The two reasons for this was, of course, that he was a very fast moving preclear, very quickly moving preclear, moved rapidly up and down his time track, and he could usually move much, much faster than the auditor could follow. And the other reason for it was the subject of confronting. That I don't think Ron ever did really experience his engrams in Dianetics. I think he confronted them. And he used to go into a sort of a pitched battle with his engrams. He used to confront them. It was a part of his personality, you see. It's just like socially he would confront. I think he used to confront on his track too. And it used to get him into some difficulty in the session with the auditor, and because there he was confronting his engram, and he shouldn't have been confronting them. The preclear is supposed to experience his engram. He's supposed to examine them. That means to experience them, to know them. He's not supposed to be in there confronting them with anything. He's supposed to be simply the auditor might want to do a bit of confronting, but the preclear is supposed to be experiencing his engram bank, not confronting it. It's a fine technical point, but I can assure you that is the way it is, that you don't get very far as a preclear in Dianetics or in Scientology if you set out to confront your bank. Ron used to talk about confronting your bank, but it was a mistake. It was the only thing he ever knew how to do. He didn't know how to experience because he was a confronter. The only way he knew how to handle life was to front it with something, put some energy mass there, and use that energy mass to front life with, while he sat in the background and charged up this energy mass there. And that was the way Ron was as a man. Now, as I said, if you know that about him, you understand that about him, you understand, really do, you have really got him, you really understand, because all of his behaviour then starts to make tremendous sense. As it did to me, to Anne and I, as we got to know him better, it all began to fall into place. We started to examine the man and understand the man in terms of his behaviour, and in terms of our increasing knowledge of Dianetics and Scientology. During the period of the 1950s, there when I knew Ron, he was not the. The subject of finances, which became quite obsessive with him in his later part of his life, didn't really concern him at all. He was only concerned with tech, and he certainly, the organisations and so forth in 1952, when it started in London, right through to about 1956, when the unit system was brought in. Well, during that period from 52 to 56, the salaries and the payments and so forth in the Hazy London were well above average for commerce and business. I was an executive during that period, and my pay was way up and an ordinary staff auditor coming straight off course could earn more money as a staff auditor than they could working in an office or working in a factory. The average wage at that time was about £8 a week, I suppose. Well, now about less than that, about £7. Well, you could earn £10 a week as a staff auditor in Hazy London any old time for a week of staff auditing. You could earn £10. That was before the unit system came in. So Ron was not a mean payer. He was a very generous payer. He was an extremely generous person too during this period when I knew him. Extremely generous person of his time. If a person was in trouble, I've known that man to stay on the phone for an hour and a half of the night time to get some pretty clear out of difficulties. Who was in difficulties, and and the auditor would phone Ron, and Ron took over the session, and he was on the phone for an hour and a half getting that person out of difficulties, that pre-clear out of difficulties. In other words, the auditor had got bloody pre-clear into a mess and got phoned up Ron in a panic at midnight, so help me. And poor old Ron has to stay up till up after an hour and a half to patch up this crummy bit of bloody auditing that this crummy auditor had done. He shouldn't have been auditing this type of pre-clear at that time of night, you know. But nevertheless, Ron would give, not think anything of it, spend an hour and a half on the phone, give of his time there. Get the pre-clear squared around there. He was that sort of man. He was a very, very generous man and very, very generous financially to his staff. We were all treated very well, and our hours of work and so forth were quite congenial. There was no question of exploitation. There was a good team spirit and good pay, and we were quite a good team. While Ron was present. Now, I say while Ron was present advisedly, because while Ron, quite often during that period from 52 to 55, early 56, when we were on staff and so forth, in close contact with Ron, that Ron will be out. He'd be away in America, or he'd be on holiday somewhere. He'd be out of London. He simply wouldn't be there. And we would be on a comm line of air letters to the old man. It was long before the days of telexes and so forth, and all the communications were by mail. And it was then we began to realise that the weakness of the man's personality. Ron was at his best when the person he was dealing with was in front of him. When the person was distant from him that he was dealing with, he started to get to his worst. Ron was hardly the same person on a comm line, on a distant comm line, than he was when he was with you in the same room. He was in good control of the situation when he could perceive it, and so forth, in present time. It was something he could put his paws on, he could handle it, and he could do it. And he was a darn near genius at doing it. But put him at a distance, and he was at his weakest. Now, what exactly was his weakest? What was that exactly? His weakness at a distance. Well,